This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow is Parking Day here in Chattanooga and around the world. For more on what it is and how it's taking place this year, we turn to Eric Myers, Executive Director of Chattanooga Design Studio, and Kate Irvin with CDOT, the Chattanooga Department of Transportation. Eric, Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow is Parking Day. We should remind folks what that is.
Parking Day is an event that happens every year globally, actually, where artists and community members and small businesses, activists for public spaces, different local governments, they all collaborate to transform very specific parking spaces, metered parking spaces, in fact, into temporary mini parks or parklets, as many people call them. And this is an event to really highlight the importance of the space usage that we have in our communities, in our cities in particular, and how parking and parking vehicles takes up so much space in most all of our cities across the globe.
It's sort of an excellent opportunity to creatively reimagine what those parking spaces could be if they weren't just housing cars. And it's a fun place to kind of allow businesses and community members, government, kind of everybody to get to put on their creative hat and play a bit with our streets. And I think we don't always think to be playful with our roadways.
And to be playful is a way to spark conversation about how better to use those spaces the rest of the year.
Exactly.
That's exactly right.
Now, of course, tomorrow is going to be different for Parking Day, given the circumstances that we're all living with now. It's going to be virtual. How's that going to work?
That's right, Ray. We've been hosting, if you will, or facilitating Parking Day for about 3 years now at the Chattanooga Design Studio. And we know that this year has to be different. You know, we can't have the gatherings surrounding Parking Day as an event that we've been having. We need to physically distance from one another. And so we've decided to turn Parking Day virtual this year. And so most of the events that will be occurring with Parking Day will be happening on social media. And more importantly, we felt that this year's Parking Day should directly link and partner with the Department of Transportation's program called Sprouts.
The Department of Transportation, in kind of early days of the pandemic, launched a program called Sprouts, which the idea behind it is to kind of reimagine how we're using our largest public space in the city, which is our roadways, to support the community, whether it's local businesses being able to expand their footprints outside into the sidewalk, parking lanes, or with what's been happening on Broad Street the past couple of weekends, fully into the roadway with closures and kind of increasing their capacity. We're looking into doing also kind of expansions of streets to allow for more recreation space and kind of play space. So the idea behind Sprouts was to really reimagine our streets as places and kind of places that we can interact with. And that really links quite well with the idea behind Parking Day. And so the Chattanooga Design Studio will be highlighting some of these existing Sprouts, kind of parklets and other locations that have been able to, through this program, expand. And while they'll be highlighting them virtually, people can also go to them in real life and grab a pizza or have a beer outside, you know, at Tremont Tavern, for example. So it's a really great way of highlighting what we're doing in the public realm while also supporting our small businesses.
And we talked about that program over the summer, Kate. How have things been going with it so far?
They've been good. So we have a number of businesses still participating. And then most recently, over Labor Day weekend, River City Company sponsored the closure of the 200 block of Broad Street to allow the businesses there to fully expand into the right-of-way, taking up, you know, the travel lanes as well as the bike lane and the sidewalks. And that has now been extended. So every weekend in September, that 200 block of Broad Street is closed on Saturdays and Sundays to allow these businesses to really kind of really expand their footprint. And it's been really successful. And so we're kind of looking to see how we can expand that to other areas of the city and get more businesses and people involved. So it's still growing.
Where can people go online for more information? Where can people go on social media to follow all the action for Parking Day virtually?
Parking Day virtually exists as a Facebook page. So search for Parking Day on Facebook, like and follow the page. And what you'll see are posts all day tomorrow of different parklets and different exercises that are surrounding all of the Parking Day events.
And CDOT will also be kind of promoting and retweeting and highlighting on Instagram everything that kind of comes out from the design studio for Parking Day as well tomorrow.
All right. Eric, Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Tennessee became our 16th state in 1796, when the American Revolution was still a living memory for most people. In the years since, the group known as the Daughters of the American Revolution has helped to keep that history alive, and they are doing it today, here in Chattanooga in the Tennessee Valley. Linda Moss Mines is the regent of the John Ross chapter of the DAR, and her daughter, Jessica Mines Dumitru, is past regent of the chapter. Linda, Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here today.
And we have to start off when we're talking about history, the history of this chapter, the history of Daughters of the American Revolution here in the Chattanooga area.
Well, and that's true. And there are five very active chapters of the Daughters of the American Revolution in Chattanooga. Our oldest chapter is the Chickamauga chapter, and it was founded in the 1890s. One of the earliest chapters in Tennessee. Then we had the Nancy Ward chapter and the Judge David Campbell chapters that were founded after that. Chief John Ross chapter was founded in 1923, so we're coming up on our centennial. We're pretty excited, already planning for that. And then our fifth chapter, the Moccasin Bend chapter, was founded in 1954, I believe. There are options available for anyone who's interested in their heritage and their descent from someone who was a patriot during the American Revolution. There are five excellent choices for them in the Chattanooga area.
And how have these chapters told the story of the American Revolution as it pertains to this area? Tennessee was not one of the original 13 colonies, but it was soon joined the Union.
I think what you will see sort of multiple levels, if you look at even the names of the five chapters, you have four that have Cherokee Indian references to them. And that's a tribute to the fact that even during that time immediately following the American Revolution, this was Cherokee territory, especially south of the Tennessee River. In addition to that, if you looked at a compilation of all of our Revolutionary War ancestors, you would find that there are probably 2,000 or more, probably significantly more than that, individuals who are represented. And I think one of the things that most people think is I have to have had someone who was fighting on the Continental Line with George Washington. Well, I will tell you that sitting here together, my ancestors who fought in the American Revolution were pretty much dirt farmers. They were privates. They were often parts of the militia that volunteered their services and they fought. Now, I will tell you with a bit of a grimace that my daughter descends from a colonel who served as the master muster and did indeed at one point serve with General Washington. He was out of the Virginia region. I sort of resent that, but it's a fact. I think the other thing that's important for people to know about the Daughters of the American Revolution is that there are a tremendous number of patriots of color. There are Native patriots. There are patriots who never lifted a gun, but they may have furnished supplies. They may have signed oaths supporting the revolution. All of that counts as patriotic service. And I have so often had people who were interested in the DAR say, I don't have anyone who would have ever been a patriot. And then you start looking at their lineage, and I love doing the genealogy part.
I do not. I am here for the service aspect.
Exactly. We divide duties.
And that's another thing to really remember is you don't have to be a genealogist to be a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. That is a cornerstone for your application to get in. But once you're admitted, we have so many varying activities and service projects that it covers the gamut. If you really are into nature and conservation and victory gardens or bees, you can do that. If you're a big supporter of the veterans, we do that. If you're a teacher and want to focus on education in the schools about history or service projects, we have that. And so it's not a one peg fits all. And we are not, it's good to point out that I think people have an image in their head about what the DAR is or was. It's little ladies sitting around with teacups in a social civic gathering. But we are so much more than that. In fact, we have a slogan, we're today's DAR. And we have a lot of what we call junior members, and they're the people that are aged 40 and under. We are growing that category exponentially. And we love to be involved. And one of the big pushes that we have right now is inclusion of minorities. Because like my mom said, they have patriots. They would have ancestors that could be members. And the entire color of fabric of our nation founded our nation. And so they should be represented in the DAR today.
And that's an evolution, not only for the DAR in general, but for the DAR chapters here, even the ones that were named for Cherokee leaders.
That's so true. And, you know, there was a period of time that doing research from a genealogical standpoint, if you were doing research for someone of color, and I might point out that we actually have very active chapters in Europe. We have chapters in Spain and France and Italy. We have chapters in Mexico because the American Patriot experience was something that attracted people even from foreign nations who came here and fought. And then many of them return to their countries. You know, if you look at our Louisiana chapters, they are such a wonderful, as Ras said, a diverse tapestry of what this nation looked like. But it used to be difficult to do that sort of genealogical research because if you were a free person of color, you would appear maybe in the census. If you were not, you often didn't appear by full name. But today we have the ability to go into the National Archives. We are able to go into the state archives. And there really are more records that exist. They were just not accessible 50 years ago or 100 years ago. Today they are. And I think for me as a historian, I'm going to speak for Raz, but Raz as an attorney and someone who's really interested in civic affairs and entrepreneurship, each of those categories is important in the DAR. And to be able to bring people together who have interest. And she's right. I like doing the genealogy. I love the veteran service projects. And the other thing is that, you know, we have people who say this season of my life, I'm working full time. I have a family. I'm actively involved in my church. I don't have a lot of hours to donate right now. You know what? That's okay. We still encourage those people to join with us because the seasons of our lives change as we age. And what I'm able to do today, I was not able to do 3 years ago. I have to give credit to Raz and to our junior members because we have a number of incredibly active junior members across the chapters in Chattanooga. But Raz was regent while moving to Chattanooga, while running Art Creations with toddlers. And at one point, my late husband said, "How in the world did you let her do that?" Well, she's very service-minded and has been since she was young. So there's an opportunity for everyone at every stage.
And when it comes to the service opportunities, talk to me more about history. Talk to me more about civics. So many stories have been written for too many years about how little so many Americans know about history, especially the history of the Revolution, and civics, how government works.
The school system, unfortunately, they don't have the resources to really spend a lot of time on any one topic. They have to be focused on certain criteria for the testing results. A wonderful project that the local DAR chapters do, in fact, they do it nationwide, but specifically here in Chattanooga, is we've actually divided up all the schools in the area amongst the five chapters. And with that, we then put together packets that we contact the schools every year and provide teachers online resources, handouts that they can do. We will go into the schools, well, pre-COVID, we would go into the schools and we can offer flag protocol lessons. We can offer lessons on the American Revolution and tell fun stories. We can get dressed up in revolutionary attire to make it fun, especially for the elementary kids. We are there to be a resource to help in any way that we can to bring it alive for kids so that they're interested and they want to then learn more. And then we can provide the resources for them to do. And of course, we have so many more online resources now that they can access at home, especially during virtual learning. So I think that we're trying to help expand everyone's knowledge and excitement about our history. And thankfully, with the musical Hamilton, it's been a little bit easier. They are a little bit more interested in learning about their founding fathers. So
If the kids don't know what Hamilton is, their parents certainly do, and that helps hook them all in.
Yes.
Well, and I would also mention that, you know, for people out there who are interested in the Daughters of the American Revolution, and by the way, there is a Sons of the American Revolution. The local chapter is the John Sevier chapter. There's only one SAR chapter that's actually in Hamilton County. There are other chapters across the state. But we as a group sponsor a Children of the American Revolution chapter. And there are all sorts of activities that the kids can get into. And I think we all know as being parents and grandparents that it has to be hands-on. It has to be activity-oriented. And the CAR, which is what they are called, we focus on doing things where they, too, you know, whether they want to be part of a drum and fife corps, as they might have been during the time of the Revolution. I'm doing papers right now on someone whose ancestor was a 16-year-old drummer boy, which was actually old for a drummer boy, but a 16-year-old drummer boy in Virginia. But we do that. We do trips to historical sites. We go to reenactments. And I know that sounds kind of nerdy, but it's fun nerd. I mean, it's the kind of thing that kids can get into. I mean, how much fun is it to watch people fire cannons and then actually talk about that process, mixing together science and history and all those sorts of things. So the entire family can be involved as much or as little as they want to.
And there's no age limit on the CAR. You literally can join the day you're born. So we take them from little all the way up.
I might have signed up a couple of my grandchildren at age two or maybe one. And, you know, they attend those things that are at their interest level. And we try to do programming to draw in young people. We're very mindful of the fact that, you know, the truth of it is that today's seniors were not alive when 9/11 happened.
Seniors in high school.
Seniors in high school. So the American Revolution is so distant to their realm of probably much knowledge at all, unless they grew up in a family that loves history. And we want to make sure that they understand that who we are today is a product of who we have been all along, and that while we are a flawed nation, we have made some progress, and future progress depends on them. And how better to get someone involved being an active citizen than
Getting them involved young and getting them to engage in the civic process. And not everything that develops and shapes our nation revolves around politics. It starts with helping your neighbor. It starts with recognizing people that have served your nation. It's little things like that, that slowly one piece, one piece, one piece comes together. And that's what we're trying to tell them. They don't have to right every wrong. They just have to pick one area and do the best they can.
And where can they go online? Where can they call for more information and to participate?
Each of the five chapters has a public Facebook site. You can always log on and search for Chattanooga DAR, and the five chapters all have a site. I certainly would love, and we're very careful to help members find the chapter that fits them best as far as meeting time, location, all of that. I am very comfortable with people emailing me. My email is out there publicly as County Historian. It's Local History Counts. Amen. localhistorycounts@gmail.com. And we'll be glad to put them in touch. We suggest that people visit a couple of different chapters because sometimes you just click in a group and sometimes it's not the perfect fit.
And also you can search online either by Facebook or by the website. If they go to www.dar.org, that's the national website, and they can just learn more about the basic history behind the DAR and our motto and the things that drive us. We also have a Tennessee website, and that's tndar.org.
All right. Linda, Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Voices Worth the Listening, Three Women of Appalachia, is an oral history that captures the character of the region and smashes stereotypes along the way. The author who talked to those women and listened to their stories is Thomas Burton, Professor Emeritus of English at Tennessee State University. Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
How did you decide to write this work, Three Women of Appalachia?
Well, by indirection, really, and circumstance, which has really been the way that my other works have come about. Just like with serpent handling, that's one of the areas that I've published in. And I never intended to write any book or several books on serpent handling, but it came about by a question of a student in a class. This work was something like that. I was not pursuing it. I didn't think about it. I came across, by circumstance, one of the individuals and heard about her story. It sounded very interesting to me, and I didn't know anything about it, and so I started to interview her, and that was 4 years ago. And after multiple interviews with her, I still didn't know what I was going to do. It could be a book or a presentation someplace or something. But then I thought I would seek out some other individuals that would represent a kind of stratum that she is a part of. She has had a very difficult, that first one, has had a very difficult life dealing with all kinds of personal and outward circumstances, some of her control, some out of her control. She is in that process of making something of her life. That's how it all started. They are from all of Appalachia, but these three different women that I chose are part of the stratum of individuals who do not fit in any kind of stereotypical mold. But it's a part of Appalachia, just like many other strata. I am not writing critical articles or critical evaluations of these three women. I'm allowing them to give their own stories, their own lives, without a critic making evaluations about them. And it's kind of like they are actors, or they're individuals in a play, and we, the readers, are listening and observing them and making our own judgments and our own critical evaluations of them without any critic making them for us. There are a lot of other approaches to Appalachia, of course, of sociological, critical evaluations of individuals and of certain regions of Appalachia. That's significant, and they have their place. But we also need to listen to these individuals without putting them in any kind of stereotypical mold.
What drew you to these three women born between 1961 and 1971? One of them, the oldest, is black, and the other two are white. What drew you to these three women in particular?
As I said, with the first one, that the one that I've labeled, some would call her a good old girl, it was just by circumstance that I came across that person's life. I was drawn to it because it was so unique to me and such a wide range of problems, and yet a person who is not, she's not a race person, she's not a poor white class, she's a person who has ideals and hopes and values and is having a great deal of problem achieving them. Now, the older one, he said the black person, I happen in a way indirectly come in contact with her as well. Not as a result of the first woman, but I did think in her case it would be good to have a black person as well as two white women who also does not fit on the common kind of common road, or does not have a life on the common road and has had a different road that she's pursued, and that would complement this stratum. Because the stratum itself is pervasive throughout Appalachia, not any one area And it's also an American story. It's not uniquely Appalachian. And the second woman, the other one I haven't mentioned, she was another person that I came about to know and find out about in an indirect way. And she was a person who has been involved in drugs most of her life. That's not the only struggle she's had, but that's been a major one. And I thought that would be a good complement also to this stratum of women who are living lives off the beaten path.
What's something that you learned from these women's stories?
I didn't know that people lived the kind of lives. They dealt with, for example, homicide and assault and rape, attempted murder. And they've been involved, like that last one I mentioned, in drug abuse, although the others have had drug abuse too, and manufacturing of drugs, sales of drugs, persecution, being put in prison, their husbands being put in prison. They've experienced domestic dysfunction in their lives from their home upbringing. They've gone through child pregnancies and multiple dysfunctions with husbands and individuals and racial and gender discrimination, economic problems. I've learned something about all of that that's part of Appalachia. But I really had very little knowledge at all that women were living these kinds of lives. I dealt with mountain people up in the Colors, Ray Hicks, famous storyteller. Some of his people I've dealt with, motorcycle gang members, gypsies, travelers. This is another whole stratum of lives that I had no idea about. It was just really interesting to me, the struggle they have, the will they have to survive, and in some cases to fail. Just remarkable lives. It's all part of Appalachia. Appalachia tends to be viewed by the general reader now as poor white trash. You know, or they're from individuals from a poverty-stricken pocket and suffer lives of desperation as a result of that dense poverty in Appalachia. Well, that's one aspect of Appalachia. That's one area. That's one stratum. But there are a lot of strata that are part and as interesting lives as those that are commonly looked at.
How difficult was it for you to talk to these women, for these women to talk to you and share all of these details about their lives?
I've been very fortunate. I've been told a lot of times, well, what did you do to get them to open up to that degree, you know? How did you establish that rapport, etc.? I don't have any magic formula for that at all. I'm interested in their lives. I'm eager to listen very carefully to their lives. And as an aside, I think that's what readers need to do about Appalachia. There needs to be more direction toward individuals and listening carefully, sympathetically, empathetically about their stories. That's all I do. I find these people very interesting, amazing lives, all kinds of problems, struggling with life, and their lives being very empathetic. They're genuine people. And that's all it's been with me. And that's, if it's anything, just being a good listener and being concerned about what they have to say.
All right. Thomas Burton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. This week, we said one can make a difference. And we would like to say thank you to so many who did. On Tuesday, you helped us raise $25,301 to support WUTC and help the Chattanooga Area Food Bank feed people in need. We would like to salute our partners at the food bank by again sharing their work in their own voices. Here's Abby Marcus, event planner and community engagement coordinator at the food bank, which covers 20 counties in Southeast Tennessee and Northwest Georgia. Abby, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There's more than one way to get involved with the food bank, and we're talking about food drives and fundraisers. Tell me first about online food drives.
Online food drives, also virtual food drives, are very popular right now, and it's because of everything that's going on in the world. The difference between the online fundraiser, online food drive, and the typical food drive is that this one is online and you collect monetary donations through your friends and your families, your coworkers, anyone that you want to share it with. So how you would create an online fundraiser, online virtual food drive, is by going to our website and clicking Get Involved. And under that tab, you'll see Host a Virtual Food Drive. There, you can set up your own personal page. You can customize it as you wish. And when you are done, a customized link will be created for you to share as you wish. This way, you can collect the monetary donations, and it's very important to mention here that $1 helps us provide 4 meals. So that way, when you're sharing this with your friends and your family and your peers, they can donate as they want to.
Tell us more about traditional food drives, how they help provide essential supplies for your programs, especially right now, given the conditions we're living with now.
Traditional food drives are also awesome. Really keeps us afloat. So whenever somebody donates a can, it goes directly into our emergency food boxes that goes right out our back door. So that's why it's so important right now, is because so many people are needing our help. So by donating that can, you are immediately helping those in need.
And then there are fundraisers that are partnerships, as you are partnering with us and we are partnering with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who want to host a third-party event, those are awesome because you're getting the word out on behalf of you, and you are helping us by collecting the funds, by raising awareness. It is awesome what third-party events can do and how far they can go within our community.
You need volunteers.
Yes, absolutely. Right now, we need volunteers more than ever. And I want to stress that we are following the CDC guidelines. Everyone has to wear a mask, gloves, we're social distancing. We're making sure that our volunteers and our employees are safe, especially during this time. So we just ask that if you have the free time, if you are willing, please come help us volunteer. One volunteer hour helps us provide 92 meals. So anything that they can do would just be so grateful for. So when people volunteer, there's a variety of different things they can do. They can sort the cans that go into our emergency food boxes that get delivered from our traditional food drives. They can do that, or they will be helping in our emergency food box area, giving the food to those individuals who are in need. We also have another area of opportunity to volunteer at our mobile distribution sites. I do want to stress that these are no touch. Therefore, the volunteers will just be putting the food in the client's car, and we're social distancing there as well. There's no touch, so they don't have to worry about that. And it's another awesome opportunity.
All right, Abby, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Ray.
Dory Cooper is Nutrition and Programs Coordinator at the Food Bank. Dory, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You work with schools on programs such as Sack Packs, mobile pantries, and in-school pantries. Start by telling us about Sack Packs.
Our Sack Pack program provides bags of food for children to take home on the weekends to help combat weekend hunger. So that's for children that may not have access to food when they're not getting those necessary school meals.
And then mobile pantries?
Our school mobile pantries typically take place right after school hours, and that allows families to come directly to the school during, usually during pickup time, to also grab groceries, and those happen once a month. They're able to walk away with quite a bit of food. So it's a really great program to connect parents to the school community even more, typically run by teachers, a very positive impact on the school and the families.
And then tell us more about in-school pantries.
In-school pantries is one of our newest programs. Right now it's operating in 2 schools, and we're hoping to expand that throughout this year. And in-school pantries provide food that the schools can give out to children and families with a little bit more flexibility than the SACPAC program. So they're able to choose different foods that go into their bags, as well as do their own food drives to support the pantry even more. So it gives the schools a little more autonomy and allows for some creativity in their programming.
How does the food bank ensure these programs offer flexibility and variety to adapt to the needs of communities and schools, even before COVID and now certainly during COVID?
We've been dedicated, like you said, before COVID, but especially now, to making sure that our programs meet the needs of the communities and schools we work with. And we work with schools throughout our service area in Chattanooga, but also rural Tennessee and North Georgia, and each community has a different need. So I work very closely with checking in multiple times throughout the year with our schools, asking them questions about what foods are being accepted by the children, what they would prefer, trying to make sure that we're providing food that the children are consuming as well. That's our number one priority. So that looks different everywhere. And then, of course, every school is different, especially now with changes due to the pandemic. We are working with different school systems, different hours, different days, opening, closures. And so we want to make sure that we're still able, no matter what, to get food to children and families. So that looks different everywhere, and it's been a little bit of extra work on our part, but it is a huge priority of us as the food bank to ensure that children are getting food.
And these are part of the preparations already in place to continue these programs, regardless of whatever may happen next with COVID and how that may change school schedules again down the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're in touch very frequently, always coming up with creative solutions and working with partners that really do care about their students and communities and are dedicated as well as we are to making sure that we find a way to get food to children.
And as a nutritionist, how do you balance nutrition with providing foods that kids like to eat?
That's definitely a balance that we work on throughout the food bank. But with kids, as most people know, that can tend to be a little bit more tricky. So the way that I personally try to balance it is, one, we try to do all of our programs based off the USDA MyPlate standards. But I also try to choose foods that excite kids. So, you know, I may do Honey Nut Cheerios so that they get a little bit excited about a slight treat, something that they'll consume. And then also make sure I have those healthy foods in there too, like apple sauces, whole grains, trying to do a balance because we want the kids to be excited about these SACPACs and in-school pantry programs by providing food that they like, but also making sure that it has that nutritious value as well.
And tell us about the garden.
So on site at the food bank, we do have a beautiful teaching garden. This garden space grows produce that we use in our emergency food boxes on site. So that supports that program and provides the fresh food grown right there on site. And then we also use it for educational experiences as well. And right now that's slightly limited due to limitations from COVID, but we are working on plans to continue to do that even through the pandemic. And it's also just a beautiful reminder to visitors and staff that providing nutritious food to our community is a priority that we have at the food bank.
All right. Dori, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Beth Riggs is Agency Relations and Program Manager for Hamilton County at the food bank. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us more about the Emergency Food Box program here in Hamilton County.
Our Emergency Food Box program, it comes from our voucher writing partners here in Hamilton County. So we have multiple voucher writers who support our Emergency Food Box program. So what happens is a client will call in to 211 United Way's help hotline, and they will say that they need food assistance. And before COVID, They would be referred to a voucher writing agency like a church or a nonprofit, and they would receive their voucher there and then come here to the food bank. However, due to kind of crazy circumstances, we have moved to pretty much exclusively virtual vouchers. And so what that means now for clients is when they call in to 211, they give that information directly over the phone to the United Way representative, and they're given a voucher number, which they can then come here to the food bank to redeem, and they get a full cart of food, and they can do that once every 30 days.
And in response to the increased demand due to COVID, capacity was tripled.
It was, yes. So we were seeing a pretty standard amount for several years, but when COVID hit, our capacity did triple. And so while it fluctuates, it varies a little bit from day to day, our operations team has done a really, really incredible job of preparing us for should that increase happen again.
Tell us more about this no-touch distribution style that you were talking about.
So as clients come to the food bank with their voucher number ready to go, they're met at the door. No one is entering the building. They give their voucher number and their name outside of the building. And once that's been verified, we have a volunteer who will come out through our other back door and bring them a cart of food that the client then can load into their car. So there's no contact. Previously, we had a shopping experience for clients, but to really protect them, we have pre-bagged and boxed everything ready to go. So it's a pretty quick in and out for clients now.
And let's talk about community food pantries, those people and organizations behind charitable food programs within neighborhoods to provide that help close to home.
So normally we work with a regular pantry, which would be a single church or a nonprofit. What really sets a community food pantry apart is that it's run by a group of different people. So that could be different churches coming together, nonprofits, organizations, neighborhood associations, and all of those people are coming together to provide a food assistance program for their community. So with this model, we're hoping to be able to create more accessibility for clients as their food, instead of having to go around the city trying to get food assistance, the food will be right there in their neighborhood, working with organizations that they already know and trust or have friends who are a part of, and it really helps create more accessibility for that food.
And again, if people want to get an emergency food box, what's the first step?
Should you or anyone you know need any food assistance, you would call United Way's hotline, which is 211. And when you ask for food assistance, they'll ask for some basic information, your name, address, date of birth, that kind of thing. And once you have given them all that information, they will give you a voucher number, which you will then bring straight to the food bank. And when asked, you will just give that number and your full name, and you'll receive your food once every 30 days.
All right. Sarah Beth, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Keisha Hamilton is Food Rescue Retail Coordinator at the Food Bank. Keisha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You lead the Retail Rescue Program that supplies the emergency food boxes. Tell us more about that.
I do. So the Retail Store Donation Program, basically what that is we partner in our 20 counties. We partner with all the national and our local retail grocery chains. So places like Walmart, Food City, Food Line, Publix, Aldi, that type of thing. We actually partner with them. And what that does is the food that used to be years and years ago before this program started, that used to be not marketable necessarily for their customers, something that they would be putting on their shelves. So it used to go in the garbage basically years and years ago. We are now set up to where we rescue that food and it's going on clients' tables that day or the next in most cases. So it's still perfectly edible food. It's just not something that was marketable for them to put on the shelf. So basically, some examples of that, these are the examples I normally give, like say a banana. As soon as that starts to spot, a lot of retail locations will pull that from their shelves. We still know that that's a perfectly fine edible banana. So that will actually be donated to us. The same with like bags of fruit. So say there's a few bad apples in a bag or a few bad oranges. Instead of that getting thrown into trash, it's actually donated to us or one of our partner agencies in our 20 counties. We pull out that bad and donate the rest to our clients.
And approximately 80% of food rescued from retailers goes to your partner agencies across that 20 county service area. Rescued retail items, they took a dip after COVID hit because of the increase in consumers buying food. Tell us more about that.
It did. So I'm sure you experienced this yourself, as well as the people listening to the program. You walk into a grocery store and the shelves were near empty for a while. So that also affected us. Our retail locations were having issues keeping their stock supplied. So whether that being because customers were buying up that product, especially those shelf stable items and meat items, just not knowing if they were going to get sick, if they were going to be stuck in quarantine, and if for how long. So the retail grocery chain actually experienced a boost in sales, which was great for them, not so much for us. So we actually did experience a little dip in the beginning. I would say the first 3 months of the pandemic, we went down over 20% in donations. But thankfully, we are starting to experience those donations come up again and kind of level out to where we used to be. So we're excited and just grateful that things are starting to come back.
And retailers also support you year-round. Tell us how.
They do. So with this, we like to think of it not just as rescuing that food on a day-to-day basis, but also that those stores are community partners with us. So they are on the same mission as us. They want to feed those hungry and help eliminate hunger in our region as well. So with this, we're able to partner with them throughout the year with things like food drives that they do for us, register campaigns where they raise money for us. And the great thing about it is what they're doing, it stays local right there in their communities. So being at the Chattanooga Area Food Bank, we service 20 counties. So we can't physically at the Chattanooga Area Food Bank go out into those 20 counties, but we have our partner agencies already in those communities, those being churches, food kitchens, that type of thing. They're right there in those communities. So everything that these stores are given is staying right there and helping those folks. We all like to know that wherever we give, it's helping our local communities. And those retail stores love that. They love helping, giving back to their community. So,
all right, Keisha, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Bassett. I really appreciate you.
We appreciate you too, and everybody there at the food bank.
Thank you.
Here on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, theater students are adjusting to life under COVID-19 with their talents. DeAndre Anderson is a senior, and Julia Walker is a junior here at UTC. Julia, DeAndre, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And you folks are coming back with performances, of course, having to stay safe. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so they told us pretty early on before like auditions that there were going to be two shows this semester. The first of which was going to be a live in-person show. The second is fully virtual. That'll be a slightly different game. But with this new one, they had said that there were going to be social distancing guidelines. There was going to be like a lot of precautions in place. So Dre is actually in the show. So I think he can talk more about what's happening in the room right now.
Yeah, so it's been very interesting putting together a play in the midst of a pandemic. So some of the things that we've incorporated into making this come alive is, so the actors on stage will be acting out the play. We're doing the Bald Soprano. It's an absurdist play. We think that it fits the time right now in 2020 with COVID and everything going on. So you have physical actors on stage that's going to have a mask that's going to be acting out the lines, but then you have voice actors backstage that's going to be reading the lines. So we have only two voice actors, so it's really cool to see the two of them do all the lines for all six of the characters. So it's going to be a very interesting thing to see come alive on stage.
In preparing for this so far, what are some of the challenges that you all have faced?
Some of the challenges that we have faced as actors have been having to learn how to act out things without our voices. I think a lot of the actors have realized that we lead with our voices, that makes our choices. So it's kind of interesting to have to figure out other ways to convey the message without being able to do it with our physical mouths. So it's a lot of miming. There's a lot of over the top, like, oh, whoa, whoa. It's just really weird. But that's kind of the biggest challenges I feel like we're facing.
You mentioned that this work, The Bald Soprano, is an absurdist work and it's appropriate for this era. Without giving too much away, set it up for us.
We're in this world where a lot of things just kind of come out and it's missed. A lot of lines, a lot of events that happen in the show, are like, whoa, what just happened? But none of the characters take time to really process what's going on. And I think it kind of correlates to what's going on in 2020 with the pandemic and just everything. I think there's a lot of big things happening, but it's to the point where we're not even really able to really process it, because before we can even process, the next big thing is happening. So it's kind of that theme. One of my favorite parts of the show is a clock. There's this clock that always kind of go off throughout the piece. It happens when something absurd happened, and the actors never react to what just happened. It's just like, okay, on to the next thing. It's really 2020-ish. That's all I can say.
From every aspect of everything we're doing for the show has to be, you know, with COVID kind of guidelines. So I've been going in through the costume shop, and we've been having to like unpack a lot of stuff. And I know that it's like super tricky because we're moving back into our old space on top of the pandemic to get a show up and running. But I think everyone is doing it very well from everything I can see. It's been safe and fun from what I hear from everyone in the cast.
And then beyond this performance, what's next?
The next show is Antigone, which is a Greek drama, and it will be online. So that's really cool. It's going to be over like almost a Zoom-esque kind of thing with all the actors filming themselves. And that will be how that's presented, which is really interesting. And then we also are trying to come up with as many performance opportunities as we can for everyone through APO, our student organization with the theater department. So we've got open spotlight on the books and stuff like that, which is just like places for us to perform, even if it does have to be virtually, so that we can really like make the most out of a semester that kind of lined itself up to maybe not be as exciting, but we're trying not to let that happen.
And where can people go online for more information?
They can go to utc.edu/theater, and it should pop up all of our information for the season and how you can watch.
E-R-R-E.
R-E.
All right. Julia, DeAndre, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.